And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, here's an anomaly. You've commented on this to me privately. The economy, in a macro sense, seems to be doing pretty good. Profitability, of course, was restored a long time ago, and the profits are higher than ever. Now, unemployment is lower than in recent periods. And that's not just because there are a lot of jobs created. It's more because people are coming into the labor force and getting jobs. People who had withdrawn from the labor force are now reentering the labor force, and yet the number of unemployed is lower, which means more jobs have been created. All of this is happening under Biden's watch. Biden gets no credit for it. How do you account for that?
Oh, there's a few ways. Well, first of all, we should mention, because people could mention to other people what's happening. More jobs were created under Biden than any other president in the shorter period of time. I think it's over 8 million jobs right now. Not all of it is his doing, but it occurred under his watch, so he should get credit for it. And we just had a figure this week that the new jobless claims reached a low that hasn't been seen since the Great Society, since the late 1960s. And the number of the employment rate, as you mentioned, the unemployment rate is 3.6%, which economists used to call that around 3% used to be full employment.
4%.
Yeah. So yeah, 3-4%. So you're there. Part of it is that, you know, when any of these numbers come out, you hear Biden's going to talk at 11 in the morning. He goes out, he gives a little speech, he goes back in, and that's basically the end of it. They don't have this machinery, or they don't have this mindset to create a machinery or to use machinery that's there to amplify all of this. You know, Fox News has its machinery that plays to its audience. But the audience for the rest of this is kind of spread out. You know, the CNBC audience isn't all pro-Biden, and they just sort of absorb this thing. They don't go out and brag about it. The other part about it is the wording that you used, the macro versus the micro. People generally live in a micro world, not a macro world. You know, the old definition that a recession is when my neighbor loses his job. A depression is when I lose my job. People just tend to look at the narrow and what's in front of them. And then we have the opposite news that I think is being over-trumped, so to speak, but is still there. And that's the inflation that Larry Summers kind of predicted, but others said was only going to be temporary, and it's lasted more than what we consider to be temporary. But again, they failed to get out ahead of this story. It could have been predicted, and what could have been said at the outset was, look, folks, when the pandemic hit and whatever, this is a crisis, and we can treat it one of two ways. One is we can go all in and meet the crisis, or two, we can just kind of wait and see and do it marginally. And what happened is they went all in this time. Remember back in 2008, they were held back from doing things. They wouldn't let the Obama have the $1 trillion. You know, that was sort of like the marker. He had to go for something less than that. And as a result, the recovery was much slower than what it could have been. This recovery came much faster. But getting out ahead of it, they should have said, look, folks, there could be a cost to this. but we're not going to worry about the cost as much as we need to A, stop the pandemic, or at least blunt it, and B, get people back to work. And if that's going to create some inflation, so be it. We'd rather have that than people sitting at home not having jobs. And I think that that could have ameliorated some of the perceptions that are going on. But still, you know, and we have the get out in front about the gas. Say, look, back a year or so ago, there was no incentive to pump oil because oil was selling for less than they had to pay people to take the oil instead of buying the oil. And we come back so fast that the demand has outstripped the supply. The oil companies stopped supplying things. But now they should be, and America still is the number one producer of energy at this point. It's just that this is one of the consequences of having a good economy. And, it's better than having a bad economy. So we're going to have to deal with this, but we're going to have to live with it for a little while. But the alternative is much worse, and try to work things that way. And again, you need the communications and the echo chamber that the Democrats don't have.
Why don't they have it? Why don't they want to do that? You thought of it. Maybe. I'm sure other people have thought of it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a matter that nobody thought of it. It's somebody thought of it and it was rejected. So why do you think they reject it?
It, for some reason, it's not in their DNA. It's not in their DNA. They don't get it. They don't know how. And in some points, there are some people that are afraid. They don't want to pat themselves on the back too much. They think it's kind of beneath them to do that, or it's not the right way to do it. You've got to be just more accepting, or there's some naivete that, well, if we do it, people will recognize it and things will work out. And they forget, no, you've got to tell people this, and you've got to tell them over and over and over again. You know, my theories of communication, repetition, repetition, repetition. You got to create the communication. You got to create the message. You've got to disseminate the message, and you've got to repeat the message.
I think there's also another aspect. I think that is that if you're quite properly making the distinction between the micro and the macro economies. The macro economy, as you said, is the whole general picture. But you can have a very prosperous economy when you have a lot of profits being generated and jobs are created and things are being produced. And yet the wage levels are so low that nobody who works benefits from that. It's true. Yeah. They have a job. They can stay alive. They can get enough to feed themselves and so can go back to work in the morning, or maybe have two jobs and go back to work in the evening as well. And yet the macroeconomy seems to be booming. The microeconomy, people are suffering. Most Americans, as you say, live in the microeconomy. And for most Americans, it's only recently that pay has been going up and the rate of inflation is taking away the increase in pay so that the pay stands still. It's still generally true that American workers make the same today, have the same purchasing power today that they had 30 or 40 years ago. Despite the enormous growth in wealth and the enormous wealth generated by the work of American workers, they don't keep it. It goes to the 100 trillionaires who live in the world. And the how many? 900 billionaires who live in America. There used to be 300. Now there's 900 billionaires.
Yeah. Yeah, the separation that's occurred in the economy, that this wealth gap that's only increased is devastating for democracy, and it's devastating for people's lives. I absolutely agree. You have two people in a room. One's making $1 million and one's making $50,000. You say, well, the average in that room, they're making, you know, $525,000.
Exactly. Yeah. Complete lie. Although it's true.
It's true, but it's completely misleading.
Yeah.
And that's what's been happening. And the people at the top haven't been they talk about this, they've kind of, the people who've gotten up there have, it's been described as they pull the ladder up with them and stop people from climbing that ladder. And also, I think what's happened is there's this other phenomenon, this culture that's invaded corporate America. The change that occurred 50 years ago with Milton Friedman, where he said the only thing corporations should concentrate on are profits. I'm actually putting an article together on this. So I've been looking at it, and that there are no other stakeholders. Employees are not stakeholders. Customers are not stakeholders. Only the shareholders are stakeholders. And it's created not only this gap in wealth, but a certain meanness and a certain, your friend Tom Hartman calls it a sociopathy, the way that certain corporate heads look at things and look at the people that they're serving. And it takes a broad thing. You know, you get the Martin Shkreli's who have no qualms about raising the price 500% or 750% on drugs.
7,000%, which is what he did do.
Whatever. Yeah. You get this president of Applebee's. It came out recently, a couple of weeks ago. He sent a memo out saying that he was rooting for hard times because that way people would come back and to the workforce and be willing to work for less. He doesn't want to uplift his workforce. He wants them to be just peons.
He's a believer in the Milton Friedman approach.
Yeah, the Milton Friedman approach. You've got the, the Amazon, the way they treat their workers, their warehouse workers and whatever. And we're finally starting to see some cracks in that type of management or the results of that type of management. We finally had as we mentioned, I think last week, the warehouse workers in Staten Island agreed to form a union, and they're still fighting that. Amazon is going to fight. They actually came out with a memo this week. I don't know if you saw it, about how people can't mention certain things. They can't mention union. They can't mention the word plantation. They can't. They could get people fired for that. That the people in middle management are not supposed to even talk about these things. And it's
the Amazon management has raised legal objections and formal objections to the Staten Island workers' vote. They say the election should be thrown out and should be held again because the union coerced the workers into voting for the union. Now, the union at that moment of the election consisted of three fired Amazon workers. That was it. It wasn't an AFL-CIO effort. It wasn't an organized labor effort. It was a group of fired workers, a handful, three, four, who got together and carried out this campaign. They had no ability to coerce anybody to do anything.
Meanwhile, Amazon hired professional union busters to come in and hold meetings and to discourage people and to try to intimidate people and what have you.
Yeah.
That memo about communication sounds an awful lot like the law that they passed in Russia, which says you can't call it a war.
Right.
You can't talk about deaths or anything like that. And, there's a parallel. It's the kind of laws that Republicans are passing all over the country in state legislatures.
Yeah.
You can't, down in Florida and whatever, you can't mention sex or gender or gay. You can't
or racism.
Racism. Yeah, that's the big one. You can't talk ill of the state as to what really happened. In an antebellum South.
Yeah.
God forbid people should know that slavery wasn't the greatest thing on earth since sliced bread, you know?
Yeah. Listen, in a capitalist economy, the kind that we live in, you have two mechanisms for regulating the economy. One is government intervention or regulation. The government, on behalf of the people, says you can't make more than this percentage of profit. It does that. It can do that. Or you have to have these kinds of conditions of employment. You can do that. You can't pay less than that, or you can't charge more than that. Governments do that everywhere. That's one way of regulating the economy. Another way of regulating the economy is through the actions of the market. If you want to rely on the market, then you have to have equal forces. You have to have forces that have equal strength. If corporations have the force of money and the force of employment, workers have to have the force of unionization.
Yeah.
That's the form of regulating the economy through the market and not through the government. If you're against doing it through the government, you ought to support doing it through unionization.
Yeah. But actually, you need some of both.
But the employers have managed to drive out the unions from functional participation in the market.
But what we're overlooking is the fact that when you have management or when you have unions, that they can then affect government policy through the mechanism of lobbying.
Yes.
And what we've had is this imbalance, this tremendous imbalance between corporations and workers in being able to do that. The most obvious right now is, of course, that in many places, 7.25 is still the minimum wage. It hasn't changed in 9 years, but compared to what you mentioned, you know, going back several decades, it should be somewhere in the 20s. At this point,
should be $26 minimum.
Yeah,
minimum wage, $26.
In order
to keep up with inflation.
Right.
If you keyed it to productivity, then the average wage would be nearly $60 an hour.
Yeah, but meanwhile, of course, the ones that are reaping the benefit, this gap that occurs by keeping these wages low, are the CEOs.
Yeah,
and the management of companies is taking all the money. Again, that goes to who are the stakeholders. And in fact, to some extent, management works against the shareholders. I know I hold stock, and this is the season that I'm getting all sorts of reports and proxy votes from the various companies. And of course, you know, it's not really a democracy. They ask you to vote for a slate of directors that you don't know anything about, that they didn't run in primaries. They don't put out their policies. These are handpicked by management, and I'll wash your back, you wash mine type of people. And then there's always the vote there, and it's only an advisory vote, the management compensation packages. And you look at some of these companies, and the management, the CEO is getting 30, 40, some cases $100 million or more in a package. And you wonder, wait a minute, if the stockholders are supposed to be the stakeholders, isn't that stockholder money? You're taking money from a select group of stockholders, which is smaller than the group of workers and customers, and you're pushing that up to even a smaller group of upper management, and you know this is what we're still seeing. And of course, the Biden administration is trying to put an end to some of that stuff, and they're running into very steep resistance.
They may be trying to put an end to it, but not publicly.
That's true.
I mean, you don't have any of them coming out on the stage and saying this corporate rapaciousness here, we have to stop it.
Yes.
They don't say that because they think they can get along with these guys whose real representative is Joe Manchin. And they don't seem to be able to get along with Joe Manchin, can they?
No.
No. And therefore, they're not going to get along with the guys Joe Manchin is fronting for and is the political tool for. And you see, and so in Pennsylvania, you know, in our elections now, where you say, well, Conor Lamb is kind of a Biden-type guy, and he's running against John Fetterman for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. And Fetterman, as you pointed out last week, has a 30-point lead in the polls, both internal polls and public polls, over Conor Lamb. And so Conor Lamb's allies are attacking Fetterman as a socialist, instead of trying to figure out a way to make propaganda that will turn working people into supporters of this Democratic candidacy.
Yeah. Yeah, they've gone negative, and it doesn't seem to be working. It's only going to hurt Fetterman to some extent.
It's not going to help Conor Lamb.
No, it isn't. I don't think there's anything at this point that can really help Conor Lamb. The only thing, but what can help Fetterman is the Republicans are spending a lot of time attacking each other and not the Democrats. I mentioned to you the other night, my wife and I were watching the news, and there's a break for a couple minutes, and there's four ads come up, and all four of them were ads by either attacking Dave McCormick or attacking Mehmet Oz, the two supposedly leading candidates for Senate, will be squaring off against Fetterman.
One guy's a billionaire, and the other guy only has $400 million in his yeah. bank account.
Yeah. But and they all have, and they both have really big skeletons in their closets.
Yeah.
But we've seen that, you know, and it's, you know, talking about ads and whatever. This seems to be a funny year in terms of the races, the local races. I mentioned to you that I'm not seeing very many yard signs for any of the candidates. Last year at this time, the whole area was choking in yard signs. You couldn't drive down the street.
When is the primary?
Primary is May 18th.
So we've got like a month.
Yeah, a little over a month. And this is the prime season. Part of it was the fact that things got delayed by the court with the reapportionment and redistricting, and people didn't know where they were. But still, you know, there's the other saying that signs don't work. I'm sorry, signs don't vote. People vote. But if you put a sign in your yard, I'm not talking about signs along the highway, which is also something else, but if you put it in your yard, if you put someone, you're pretty sure that's who you're voting for. A sign along the highway doesn't say who's voting for. It's just to get name recognition out there. This year, there just seems to be a lot of
Republican signs in a county. Makes Democrats demoralized and tends to make sure that many of them don't come out to vote. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
Signs are important. Well, signs are not unimportant.
No. No. It's, like I said, they've got a different dynamic to them.
Yeah.
But still, this year it's kind of funny. And there's ads going, you know, back and forth. On other races. I haven't seen, interestingly, anything for Jim Bognet yet. He's running against Matt Cartwright, but his opponent, Marcia Cano, is already out there with a pretty good ad, saying, I'm a former state trooper, I'm a veteran, and he goes at it. He throws the Trumpisms in there. But,
and in the Republican race for the nomination for governor nomination, the two most extreme right wing candidates seem to be leading, right? Mastriano and Barletta.
It's hard to know who's more extreme. I mean, Dave White's pretty extreme as well out there. And
I'm not trying to defend Dave White, but I've always thought that Mastriano was really quite exceptional since he openly asks for the ending of the separation of church and state.
Yeah,
he thinks there should be a theological state. That's his campaign.
You know, we're seeing more and more of this, particularly in Republican politics. It's been there all along since the moral majority threw their weight behind the Republican Party. But we're seeing more and more of this theological bend. It's part of what motivates Ginni Thomas. it's part of what we're Amy Coney Barrett, that we see, the Republican majority on the Supreme Court that keeps endorsing religion over people's rights. You know, these rulings that I have a deep-seated religious belief, and therefore I should be able to discriminate you in public ways, not just in private ways, but in public ways, so I don't have to bake a cake for you, or, you know, and the logical conclusions of where that leads. And now they're trying to undo essentially the 60s. You know, well, it came out with the vaccines. I have a religious belief that the government can't force me to take a vaccine. They can't, that kind of thing. So we're seeing that more and more as well out there.
And the Supreme Court, with Alito in the lead, upholds right. those things when they get to them.
You know, you talk about the Supreme Court. Of course, this week we had the approval of now justice to be Ketanji Brown Jackson, first black woman who will be serving on that court. But we have that interview with, and it's not going to make a big difference in the voting right now. She's just replacing an older liberal on the court, or someone who tends to be on the left side of the court.
But not very left. He's hardly a left winger.
No. He's been a pretty pro-business type of guy.
Yeah.
But they have, you had that interview this week with Mitch McConnell, who single-handedly has reshaped the court. He prevented Barack Obama from replacing Antonin Scalia, and he pushed through Amy Coney Barrett before an election, even though his reason for not letting Obama have an appointment was that there's an impending election. And he was asked if he became the majority leader next year, if the Republicans got control of the Senate, and there was an opening, would he approve a Biden nominee? And he didn't say no, but he let it be known that he probably would hold that seat open.
Well, he said he wasn't able to answer. He didn't know what the circumstances would be. He couldn't talk about that.
He didn't have a philosophy.
But Lindsey Graham made it very clear, because Lindsey Graham said if the Republicans were in the majority, you'd never have a Ketanji Brown Jackson nominee. You wouldn't have any kind of nominee like that. We wouldn't allow it. We wouldn't have hearings.
Yeah, and then we had, of course, McConnell then said, when he was confronted with what he said about Trump and his role in the insurrection, then was asked, well, would you support him for president? And he said, yes. He said, my duty as the head of the Republican Party is to support the nominee. He wasn't asked bluntly, well, what about your oath to the Constitution? That just didn't seem to be.
And I don't know why the newsmen don't ask them these questions.
Yeah.
I mean, it can't, if it's the case that these are news people who these questions don't occur to, they oughtn't to have the job.
Yeah, and Jonathan Swan had done considerable research on that. He knew that was there to ask, and he didn't do it. He didn't do it. Meanwhile, there's one other thing quickly. Republicans are continuing in Pennsylvania and elsewhere to outstrip Democrats in getting people registered. And it's not just new people. It's getting people converting from Democrat to Republican, despite all of these things that the insurrection and what have you. Four times as many Democrats have changed and re-registered as Republicans in Pennsylvania as the other way around. And in North Carolina, it's three times. The Democratic Party, since Howard Dean, doesn't seem to be either recognize or know how to change this dynamic.
Well, it looks like you have a situation here, a two-party system. One party wants to end democracy. The other party has no idea how to defend democracy.
You know, there was a Timothy Snyder. I saw an interview this week. He wrote the book on tyranny. And he had an interesting quote. He said, you know, the American left is used to being right, but losing. The American right is used to being wrong, but winning. So, Bill Clinton used to have the idea, strong but wrong wins, right but weak loses.
Because Snyder's quip takes as his basis the idea that the Democrats are the left. Why are they the left? I don't know that they'll let Joe, that the cinemas and mansions of the Democrats are not the left of anything.
No, the Democrats have a more widespread. The Republicans, yeah, though, are certainly the right.
Exactly. I mean, that, there may be a left wing to the Democratic Party, which there is not in the Republican Party, but it's not the Democratic Party. There ought to be a left, but I don't think it's the Democrats.
Well, they consider the squad to be the left.
But that's only a small group of within the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's it for this week. We're done.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.